Hello, everybody, and welcome to minute 87 of season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we eat the carrot away through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today from Blueprint Review is David Brook. Welcome back, David.
Hello, pleasure to be here again.
Yes, I'm glad to have you back. And you get another one of these minutes in the movie where there is absolutely no dialogue.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of action, though.
Yes, plenty of action, even a little bit of gruesome action. Which,
we'll get to that.
Yes. So the minute 87 begins with Blue Light getting ready for what seems like a bank robbery, and then ends with Blue Light disembarking the truck. So, you know, yesterday we ended things with Grant giving the order that, gentlemen, we have a situation. And then we see people switch the clips in their guns, and then they pull down these ski masks on their faces, you know, making them really look like they are about to go rob a bank. That's the first thing I think of when I see people wearing ski masks. You know, yeah. Obviously the jokes of bank robbers wearing masks don't work anymore after COVID, but still, you know, it was the point where, you know, you couldn't. There was a time when you couldn't go into a bank without a mask. Do you know what the official name is for this type of ski mask?
Is it about balaclava?
That's right. It is a balaclava.
Yes.
Okay. It is a form of cloth headgear designed to expose only parts of the face, the eyes, and mouth. Sometimes, you know, people can wear it that it only covers the eyes. Sometimes it covers just them. You can roll it down. You can, the way that they're wearing it beforehand is they wear it as hats, more or less, and then they just roll them down to cover up the different parts of their faces and stuff like that. In the 19th century, these were known as Uhlan caps, and they were worn by Polish and Prussian soldiers. And, people who are outdoor sports enthusiasts would also have these type of things in certain cold weather areas. And stuff like that. The name of a balaclava comes from, it was during the Crimean War in 1854. There was a town where there was a battle of balaclava, and the, you know, British troops were wearing knitted headgear to keep warm, and they would have these handmade balaclavas that they were using to protect them from the cold weather there. So they started like putting these masks on and then having a helmet on top of it. So, and people use them obviously for motorcycle or snowmobile helmets in order to help keep them warm when they're in cool or winter conditions and things like that. You know, you'll find it some skiers, snowboarders, cyclists, and things like that.
Yeah, I've got one for my trips to Finland. I have one. It's one with like an open face at least, but it goes all around the chin and the head and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that, you know, on the one hand, this, and it's also used in racing. You know, you'll see like in a lot of racing stuff that's one of the things they wear under their, you know, under their helmets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's just very strange the way that the fine line between what looks like a criminal and what looks like someone who's, in some sort of armed forces or something like that, or someone who's just out for recreation. Could be any and all of the above.
I guess it's to be slightly camouflaged in the snow, but yeah, it does seem odd.
Yeah. But no, it's just a very strange thing that they would use here. This is what they do. I think they did it also so that we can't tell who each of them are, because, you know, like with Stewart's men, they all have names. These guys are all nameless. Telford is the only one who has a real name.
And I guess it's the classic kind of movie trope of having one team in one color, one team in the other, like strong contrasts, just so you know who's fighting who.
That's right.
When in reality, it's maybe not that helpful.
Probably not. It's not like everyone's. It's not like it's a team sport, you know. These shirts and skins, you know, or whatever it is.
Although it helps avoid friendly fire, I guess. But still,
yes,
it marks you out a bit.
It's true, especially when you have fake snow being thrown around. You know, That definitely helps also. And then, they give us actually about 5 seconds of watching these guys, as they're putting on their masks and stuff like that. And we hear like the music starting to get more tense with the way this is. We still see that Telford is doing his radio work. He's not paying attention to anything that anything else that's going on. And then we're back to John and Baker, which actually makes me, that's really funny that I say that because John Baker was the main character, was one of the main characters on Chips. Did you ever see that TV show?
Well, once or twice. I do. Weirdly, the only times I remember seeing it is when I went to America. I used to, on holiday or something, it'd always be on in daytime or
Okay.
something.
Right. So one of the main characters is named John Baker. So I just think it's really funny that I say John and Baker. So we continue with their fight. We see Baker smashing John into like some sort of wall, and then John pushing back, and then they fly over together. It looks like they're dancing basically the way that they're doing it, and then they roll over those trash cans that they knocked into yesterday. And so where do you think the whole idea of trash cans came from? You have any idea? Like, when did they
In
start
general, or in
using?
the movie,
No. In
or
general,
trash cans.
when do you
Oh,
think they started using like garbage bins and stuff like that? And we're not
I
even talking
kind of feel
plastic.
like Victorian era. I'd have thought maybe late 1800s, early 1900s, something like that.
Very good, very good. 1875 in England, the first garbage receptacle was introduced, and it was used for the ashes of burnt garbage. They would burn the garbage then, and then they would come around, and on a weekly basis they would empty out all of the ashes from there, and people had to then pay a fee, whether they had an empty or a full bin. Didn't really make a difference. And then about 10 years later, in the US, they started doing that. New York started developing its own waste management system 40 years later in 1914, which again, they wanted people to incinerate their garbage first, and then they would take them. So I wonder what happened over the last century that people just stopped burning their own garbage.
Yeah. The smoke, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. Man, probably the smell didn't help for that type of thing. Oh well, what can you do? That's the way it is. And then they started making garbage cans in the 1950s that were made out of metal, which is what we have here. But the problem is that they would get very rusty, and they were very noisy when you would drag them around. So a man named Charles Harrison was the first person to think of the idea to create plastic garbage bins, and decided to find a way to make it that you can drag plastic garbage cans by adding wheels and things like that, which obviously makes things much easier than they were back then. He was actually dyslexic,
Dyslexic.
and therefore he would, anything that he invented, he wanted to make things that were instinctive or spontaneous so that you wouldn't have to struggle with having to understand what needs to be done, with having to read instructions and directions and stuff like that. And he created a whole bunch of different things. He also was able to create the see-through measuring cup, the riding lawnmower, the dial-o-matic food slicer, and the cordless shaver.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I
Must
mean,
have died
think
well
about
for
all the different
that.
things that he was able
Yeah,
to. I mean, you still find places that have metal garbage cans, but in general, it's mostly plastic these days.
yeah. I still have a metal incinerator at least, but yeah.
That's true also.
Which looks like a garbage can, but.
Right. Okay, that's fair. I understand that. So then, John and Baker are rolling around in the fake snow, not really doing much besides rolling around. At a certain point, he's on top of this one, and that one's on top of that one. They're not really doing anything besides rolling around here. No one's throwing any punches or anything like that. And
Yeah,
we
they're kind of
can,
holding each other off, aren't
that's right. And we can see that on the left-hand side of the screen, there's a whole bunch of chopped wood. So I guess maybe the church has a fireplace, or someone in a nearby house has a fireplace that they're constantly using and stuff. But it's just very funny the way they're struggling between the two of them, because they're really not throwing any punches whatsoever. They're just like pushing each other away from each other type of thing. That type of thing,
Yeah.
like trying to hold each other down.
A bit of
And
wrestling, I guess.
that's right. Okay, maybe. And then at a certain point, Baker then pulls out a knife in order to try and stab John. And then we basically get probably about 20 seconds here of fake struggling between the two of them. Baker is holding the knife up. You can actually see the knife. Looks like it's wiggling a little bit. So
Yeah.
obviously it's not a real knife. It's probably a little plastic. But you can see like the facial expressions on both of them make it seem as if they are both trying very hard here.
Yeah. The bad guy's face is particularly a bit over the top.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, he construed can he
Shaking
contorts
around.
he contorts his face into some very strange expression as he's trying to do that. And John just keeps looking at him, and he's trying to hold him off. And John's using both of his hands to hold the Baker's one hand. It makes me wonder where Baker's other hand is at that point. Maybe it's on John. I don't know. And they give us a nice close-up shot of the knife itself, and then we see John's eyes look above him for a second, and then look back, at where all of the wood is piled over there. Maybe he's trying to think of some sort of idea. I don't know. And then John ends up somehow pushing Baker off to the side, and then he lifts up his hand and grabs an icicle and breaks it off. And then Baker comes in for the kill, and John stabs him in the eye with the icicle. So
Nice.
it's a very gruesome shot, but it worked. It helps make this very memorable. No question about that, the way that this is. The idea is, I mean, when in the commentary, so Randy Harlan discusses it a little bit, and he says that he realizes that some people might vomit from watching this, but it's still a great choice of something that can be done. And he said, growing up in Finland, they would always have fights as kids with icicles. So for him, it was a perfect idea to use it. But they didn't use real icicles here. These are fiberglass that are being used, which I'm assuming is still pretty dangerous to use here. So th then the biggest question that one asks is, how dangerous are icicles? Do you think people have been killed by falling icicles and things like that? Not necessarily in fights, like death.
Yeah, like dropping off the ceiling of a roof or something. I'd have thought a big chunk of ice is solid, like it could definitely do some damage. I guess they're not usually mega sharp, but still, if you get a big enough icicle, I don't see why it wouldn't cause some problems.
Right. I actually found an article that
I
talks
reckon.
about the top 10 deaths by icicles. And I mean, they claim that in the US there are at least 15 people that are killed every year by icicle-related accidents. And in Russia, there's about 100 a year that are killed by that.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are just amazing. I mean, they bring a story here of someone in 2001 where 74 people were killed by plummeting ice
Wow.
in Moscow. So the earliest recorded death by icicle goes back to 1776, which is a story of a youth that died of a falling icicle. So like the question that people ask is it possible and stuff? And apparently, yes, it is. So yeah,
Yeah.
it was a kid in Devonshire, England in 1776, the son of a parish clerk, and he was killed when an icicle fell on him and fractured his skull. And apparently on his tombstone it says, "Bless my I, here he lies in a sad pickle, killed by an icicle." I don't know how true that is. That just sounds really weird. I don't
Sounds
know.
like a bit of a gag for someone's
Sounds like
tombstone.
it,
Sounds about
seriously.
right.
Yeah. In 1903, a police officer in Cassopolis, Michigan, was killed when a huge icicle fell on him and cut off the top of his head. In 2001, a 48-year-old pastor in Michigan was clearing icicles from his roof and loosened an ice dam, which fell on him and ended up killing him. And the official cause of death was bilateral pulmonary thromboemboli due to crushed lower extremities due to falling ice. Yeah, pretty gruesome. In 1994, a man named Donald Booth in Chicago had a microwave-sized chunk of ice fall off a Neiman Marcus building in Chicago, which killed him. His family sued the department store and got $4.5 million. What else do we got here? A 7-year-old boy in Springfield, Vermont, was hit in the head when he was playing outside, and he suffered from traumatic brain injuries from an icicle. In 2008, people in Chicago... In a Chicago hospital, 8 people were treated for falling ice-related injuries. And the final one that I have here is a 55-year-old woman in Stockholm, Sweden, in 2010, that her vertebrae were crushed by snow that fell off a roof. They were including icicles there. And I even found a book, which I thought was really funny. The title of the book is "Death by Icicle." It is a Shirley. It's written by Shirley Rollins Scott, and it is a Mogi and Marin mystery book. So
I had a quick look myself, and there's something came up on the YLE, which is like the Finnish most popular kind of news. It's a TV channel, but there's an article on there from 2011, dangling icicles, rooftop snow kill pedestrians. So, yeah, one person died and at least 3 people injured in Helsinki on Monday due to snow and ice falling from tops of buildings. But what's interesting in this article is they actually have the man who died. He attempted to walk through an area that was demarcated as a danger zone for falling snow. So obviously it is a problem in places like Finland where it's very cold in the winter. And so they actually have zones you're not supposed to enter because of the danger of falling icicles and falling snow.
And apparently someone wasn't listening. This guy
didn't heed the warnings and paid the price.
Apparently, yeah. Yeah, that's I actually took the summary of this book called Death by Icicle, it was just really funny. It might be a little too long to read the whole thing, but I just found it really funny that, the idea is that they find the coroner, they arrive at the scene and discover a minute hole in someone's head, and that they say that the body didn't die of natural causes. So obviously I haven't read this book, but I can already guess what's going to happen. Apparently there was someone killed him with an icicle, and the icicle melted. So by the time that they got there, they wouldn't be able to know that there was an icicle there. So.
Ooh, maybe it's a good way of killing people. Hide the evidence.
That's right. That's right. You see, I don't know how quickly the icicle in Baker's eye is going to defrost. But he gives it a nice scream, and then he slumps on John, who looks completely disgusted by the whole thing, just rolls him off, takes a look at the eye, and looks away really quickly. He's had too much, even though he inflicted this, but oh well. What can you do? And then they show us the truck again, and we see some of blue light, the truck stops, and we see 3 guys get out. And that basically is how the minute ends. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute, David?
Let's find no, I think that's good. I think that's not much to say about this one.
Okay, so the script is pretty succinct here. It says Baker yanks a combat knife from his boot and dives on McLean. Both hit the wall of the church detached garage. Snow and ice fall from the roof, but both men ignore it. McLean's left hand can't force away Baker's right hand and the knife. The bastard is strong, and now his left jumps out and pins McLean's right, so it can't help. The knife creeps towards McLean's throat. McLean is and then his desperate eyes look at something nearby. We focus change. It's a big icicle. With his last strength, McLean breaks it out of Baker's grip, grabs the icicle, and stabs it right in Baker's eye. Baker screams and falls back. McLean rolls with him and with both hands presses the icicle home 6 more inches right into the son of a brain. The body twitches, dies. McLean falls against the garage as the snow turns crimson all around, catching his breath and then reacting to a whistle. Barnes is in the street. Moving to in a crouch, McLean heads towards him. So,
it's another very descriptive script, this one, a bit like the Die Hard.
That's right. Very descriptive. The fact that it says that he pushes it in deeper, I mean, come on. They didn't do that in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Crazy.
That's right.
I guess that would make it just would make him just seem nasty, I guess. I can see why they got rid of that. But yeah, as I say, on the commentary, I think Rennie Hatley mentions how I think the studios were a little not quite sure whether to go down that route, along with another scene that I guess you've talked about earlier with the
watching the people on the plane.
Yeah, they were going to show more of that as well.
No, and they wanted it to be they wanted to be really a cargo plane
to die at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they did, but he, I think he even he, although he talked them out of that and they managed to show them, I think originally there was going to be even more kind of carnage in the plane. I think they even he said
they were going to show a little girl
on the plane.
They were going to show a little girl.
Yeah, yeah, they were going to and show more kind of carnage while when it was crashing and things, people flying around.
Yeah,
but yeah, but I think he says again, I think on this that that they weren't too sure.
You're right.
But he got his way.
That is true. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Disaster Tuesday, where I decided that the segment I'm gonna talk about. I mean, the movie has a plane crash, so I talk about real plane crashes that are somehow, you know, stories of people that we might have heard of. And you know the accidents that killed them. So what I usually try and do is try and find something close proximity wise to my guest. So the one that I found for you is do you know what happened to Prince William of Gloucester?
Of Gloucester, no.
Do you know who that is?
Well, there are lots of Prince Williams, but I'm not sure.
He was. His full name is William Henry Andrew Frederick. He was born on the 18th of December 1941, and he was the grandson of King George V, and he was first cousin to Queen Elizabeth II. When he was born, he was the fourth in line to the throne, and when he died, he was the ninth in line. He died on the 28th of August 1972. And apparently he liked doing a lot of different dangerous things, I guess you can say. You know, one of the things that he liked doing was flying planes. So he was a licensed pilot, and he was actually the president of the British Light Aviation Center. He owned several aircraft and competed in amateur air race shows. And on August 28th, 1972, he was competing in the Goodyear International Air Trophy, which took place at Halfpenny Green near Dudley. Does that mean anything to you? It means nothing to me.
Dudley, someone I used to work with came from Dudley. I know Dudley. Yeah, it's not far from Birmingham.
Okay.
So yeah.
All right. And his passenger was a man named Viral Mitchell, who was another pilot that he would race with often. They took off and they were at a very low altitude and they were flying a Piper Cherokee, and their plane banked abruptly to port, where there was an extreme increase in the rate of turn and a corresponding loss of altitude, and the wing of the plane hit a tree, which sheared it off, and then the plane went out of control and flipped over and crashed into a bank nearby, and it burst into flames. Both William and Mitchell were killed. And there were 30,000 people in the stands watching this as it happened. And it took them nearly 2 hours to control the fire. And the bodies were burnt beyond recognition. And the only way that they were able to identify them was via dental records. His father, who was Prince Henry, which I guess it means that it was Elizabeth's uncle, right? So he was in very poor health and they debated whether to even tell him. And apparently they didn't tell him, but he ended up finding out about it from he was watching the news and they mentioned it. I mean that's a pretty strange way to find that.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. So they renamed a school in Undle. It was now known as it became known as the Prince William School. And his estate value was £416,000 at the time, which is nearly £4 million today when you adjust it for inflation. He was the heir apparent of all of his father's peerages, the Duke of Gloucester, the Earl of Ulster, and Baron Culloden. And when he died, so his younger brother, Prince Richard, became the heir apparent and succeeded with getting all of these peerages in 1974. And William was the first grandchild of King George V and Queen Mary to die. So, because he was quite young at the time, and he was what was he, 30 when this happened to him. So yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't know more about this story. I guess I'm not much of a royalist. I don't tend to follow a lot of the royal kind of things, but I'm surprised I didn't know. I'd say it's before my time, but not that long, 10 years. But fascinating, crazy
Yeah,
story.
it really is. All right, so David, you want to tell people how they can get in touch with David Brooke?
Yeah, so my website is blueprintreview.co.uk. And if you look for Blueprint Review, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
All right, and while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages, here.